Hello again, everybody, and thanks for tuning in to this episode of Scope of Practice, designed to be an information resource for professionals across the behavioral health field to address topics not generally discussed openly in the field so that you can learn, perhaps research a little bit more, and form your own independent conclusions. The information presented is solely the perspectives of the guests and the hosts, and not necessarily that of the Connecticut Certification Board. The undeniable history of SUD treatment in this country revolves around the widely accepted abstinence-based model where the complete stoppage of use of any drugs is the ultimate goal. This aligns with 12-step philosophy, which, according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, drives between 70 and 80% of all treatment programs. The latest Cochrane review shows that 12-step facilitation in treatment works as well and sometimes better than other treatment options. Although criticisms of this review can be heard on a prior episode of this podcast with author and one of my favorite troublemakers, Maya Salamitz. Simply put, just like any other form of treatment, it works for the right people at the right place and the right time. SUDs have no single cause, so no single effort or treatment modality will work for everyone. And having only one choice is considered to be an unethical practice by the American Medical Association. Options are necessary to meet different needs, conditions, contexts, etc. Some options involve harm reduction efforts that meet the recipient where they're at, providing life-saving services and offer the opportunity for a healthier life in the view of the recipient. Needle exchange, drug testing services, safe use sites are some of those options. The argument on which is better is rampant all over the industry, and hardliners on both sides dig their heels in on their favorite approach. Despite any posturing and catchy slogans, the question remains, which is more efficacious? Our guest today is going to help us explore that question. Alexandra Plant is a senior advisor of substance use disorder in the strategy office of the National Council for Mental Well-Being. She is the recipient of a Fulbright Specialist Award in Substance Use Disorder, leads the National Substance Use Interest Group, and volunteers her time with the Maine Advocacy Project. She has served as a consultant to U.S. federal agencies and state policymakers, international agencies such as the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime, and private entities such as Google. Her writing has been featured in outlets such as Harvard Health Publications, Scientific American, and Psychology Today. She holds an MA in Qualitative Research and Communications, previously served as director of the Massachusetts General Hospital at Harvard Medical School, Recovery Research Institute, and Dynamic Care Health. We are absolutely thrilled that she's chosen to join us. Welcome to the program, Alexandra. That's impressive.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Let's kind of jump into what we want to talk about. You had written an article where you were collecting research on abstinence versus moderation in care. And we're looking at some of the existing research out there that was kind of saying, you know, talking about, but you never really were able to find in there, there's no way to say what's better. Correct?
Exactly. Yeah, I have been working in the substance use disorder space for over a decade, and it's just sort of foundational that especially for severe cases or severe chronicity or usage for those individuals, that abstinence is the best pathway for them. And I started to dig into the literature, and it was extremely sparse. There are studies, but I don't think the studies complement each other in a way that paints a full or complete picture. And you have currently all of these news articles and, you know, data coming out of the federal institutes really challenging the definition of recovery. And I think within that, there's been this whole debate that's opened up on, is abstinence better or is moderation better? And we don't know. We don't have the research to support it. And I think because of the lack of research, you start to get a lot of rhetoric or conversation that kind of goes in the direction of fear mongering or these ideas that certain interventions would be a silver bullet. Which is just very interesting because you kind of see that rhetoric come into spaces where we don't really know. And that's what's happening here.
And we know that the idea of fear-mongering things is kind of how things are going in the culture of this country at this point. And because it works, people will buy into something when they're afraid of something without necessarily having the research to back it. So what impelled you to write the article?
I think just seeing this growing number of articles coming out, talking about cultural changes around moderation, and really kind of the stickiness or complexities around how folks are defining themselves. So you have recovery, and you have not only national recovery study data from about 2015, 2016, but now you sort of have national data coming out of NIDA and NISDA that speaks to the fact that 60% of individuals who are saying they're in recovery or have recovered from an alcohol or other drug use problem used alcohol, cocaine, cannabis, hallucinogens within the past year. And so that just shows you what a large portion of folks are using this kind of non-traditional, I'll call it, route of moderation. And that's really coming to the forefront.
You know, I remember the arguments of whether somebody would say, I'm in recovery or I am recovered. And it got to be pretty nasty on either side. And in my head, I'm thinking, who cares what someone identifies themselves as? It doesn't affect, there are no ripples that come off if somebody says, I'm recovered versus I'm in recovery. Moderation, you're right. I'm seeing a lot more about moderation. And when I read some of the articles, they're throwing shade at abstinence-based. And then it goes back the other way, instead of kind of saying, we have this larger community and people can choose whatever option works best for them. When we talk about abstinence-based, people understand that. That's very clear. They understand abstinence-based. It's universally understood by the field simply because that's the history of our field. Can we identify for the listeners a working definition of moderation from a clinical perspective?
Well, I actually want to even challenge the abstinence assumption.
Okay.
Because I think even within the term abstinence, it gets very confusing or messy. So as somebody who has been in the field similar to you, yes, when I know what we mean when we say complete or total abstinence, we are talking about refraining from the primary substance. And then there are a list of good and bad drugs that fall into the secondary category. So marijuana is bad. That's not abstinence. Tobacco is good. You can be abstinent and do tobacco. You, according to Bill Wilson, one of the founders of AA, like you can do LSD, but you can't drink alcohol. So it's just these categories of good or bad. And I think there is some challenge around those. And there's kind of this push to say, well, I'm abstinent from this substance, and I'm abstinent from this substance or substance types or these categories of substances. But then maybe I moderate for these substances. And I don't think we really have the language right now to kind of bridge the fact that folks are mixing and matching abstinence and moderation strategies. They're challenging the traditional good and bad categories of medications. To your question, I think if we were to try and define moderation, it's the clearest way in my mind is that out of the 11 criterion that make up the substance use disorder diagnosis, you have fallen below the threshold of having a substance use disorder diagnosis. However, if you go to Health and Human Services website, like you can find very specific definitions of like what is moderate drinking. It's one a day, one drink a day for women, two for men. So it can get very specific. But I think when it comes down to it, the terminology gets very loose. And one thing I just didn't even mention that's like such a big thing with the terminology abstinence is that there is still a huge contingency that don't believe that if you use medications for opioid use disorder that you're abstinent. Like that still exists and obviously comes from a history of it being called opioid replacement therapy and then moving to medication-assisted treatments and now it's just medications for opioid use disorder. What is and is not abstinent? What is and is not moderation? It's messy.
As you were talking, something was coming to mind. Well, some of the basic clinical tools that we teach substance use counselors, meeting somebody where they're at, which we don't do as a field right there. That's a punchline that we don't follow up on necessarily. But when we look at where meeting somebody where they're at and we look at the stages of change, somebody may be in a complete effort and in action or in maintenance about their cocaine use, but yet still be contemplative about their marijuana use. And the field started to change and say, well, we can work with that instead of saying, no, you've got to stop everything except smoking. But now we're starting to understand it. So I think the moderation, the viewpoint is evolving around moderation a little bit. If it's a good drug or if it's, you know, it depends.
Yeah. And I also think treatment strategies around moderation are evolving as well. You know, one of the interesting things to note is that, well, I don't know of any for opioid use disorder, for example, or stimulant use disorder. If we're talking alcohol use disorder, you actually have topiramate and gabapentin anticonvulsants, which can be prescribed off-label for moderation for folks that want to continue to keep drinking. And then there's also some really very, very preliminary reports coming out of these semaglutides, which is Ozempic, Wegovy, these weight loss diabetes medications, that there actually are unintended side effects, which are reducing cravings and actually helping folks moderate their drinking. So just similar to medications being kind of a robust piece of abstinence for many going in the pathway of abstinence, there also appears to me to be a growing number of medications on the table that could actually be used to support a moderation-focused goal.
And this is a question that I obviously have no idea. It just came to me, and I wouldn't know the answer. Is, can research be done on off-label uses for medication? Can they do a study to see, I'll use Ozempic because that's the most common when people talk about weight loss. Can they use that, the off-label effects, and study that? Or is that unethical research-wise?
I would assume that that research has to be done by the companies themselves through the FDA. So I would not be an expert on this, but that NIDA funding for a addiction treatment research institute would not qualify, but the actual drug companies who own the patents to these medications can and do continue to test to try and get patent thickets around for like as many different new conditions as they can.
I'll have to call my friend Jeff Laredo, who's retired from NIDA, who might be able to give me a better answer. But it just came to me as you were talking about that. You know, with a dearth of research in comparing abstinence based with moderation, what did you expect to find? I'm curious about that.
I very much had it in my head that for severe chronic substance use disorder cases, that abstinence had a strong research basis as the preferable pathway. And it just isn't quite as clear as that.
So that was a bit of a surprise, huh?
It was, because I think my initial reaction was, this has been so ingrained and so what addiction treatment is that no one bothered to study it.
If we had more robust studies around that, some of the results would surprise people. And do you think that there's some fear potentially around what those surprises could be? That it's not as effective as we may believe, or?
I think there's always fear when you don't know. I think if you especially are a treatment provider and have built up your whole career or an entire business or health facility around a certain modality, it would not only have these far-reaching financial consequences to find out that you need to change your approach, but kind of on a human level to know that potentially medical advice that you gave out wasn't the best for that person at that time. Like, that could be very hard as well.
I think that as somebody with a long history of working clinically, that's always a worry when something that you're trying isn't working and you feel like, oh, and the client may find something better or something else comes along and you think, oh, I did some research on something and see it work better. You're like, oh, I wasted that person's time. It's a very, very difficult thing. But thankfully, we understand the value of the therapeutic relationship. So it wasn't wasted time. But it's a hard thing to think about.
Yeah. And I do think when sort of the question comes up of like, is abstinence under attack? It's not really the right question, though, that we should be asking. I do think that substance use disorder, like many other conditions, I think cancer is sort of leading the way in this, but need to move to precision medicine, which is using large data sets to better assess, given the myriad of individual like factors and demographics and severity and chronicity and recovery capital and things like that, what would be the best treatments, treatment combinations, lengths of treatment, places of treatment, types of treatment. And we just aren't there yet. And so everything that we're doing is a bit rudimentary. And I also will say that substance use disorder treatment has been very steeped in kind of a programmatic nature that everybody gets the same program and we run folks through the same program because the program works. And a little bit of what's going on right now is just saying, well, can we create different programs for different people? What would that look like? How would we do it? And that's a big change.
And it can be, you know, Woodrow Wilson once said when he was president, you know, you want to make enemies, try to change something. And he wasn't wrong. As you're talking, something else comes up to me. It's with the number of people in the field working who have their own recovery history. Do you feel that that makes the idea of change potentially more difficult? Because sometimes I hear from people that if something doesn't work as well, if this perspective or if there's some data that shows that whatever their pathway was, doesn't work that well for most, they feel attacked themselves. Not only is abstinence under attack, but they're attacked, saying, as if it lessens their recovery. Well, it worked for you and you got to this point. That's great. And has no bearing on what it does. Your recovery has no bearing on others, and others' recovery has no bearing on the effectiveness of yours.
Yeah. I think that's a little bit hard to answer in a simple way. I think it's different for different people. I also would guess that folks in early recovery would be more sensitive to any perceived attacks or dissent regarding their program versus individuals that are in stable long-term recovery 10 mm-hmm. years in. It is very, very much human nature to know what you as yourself have experienced and telling your kids, don't do this because that was your experience. And the same thing happens and substance use treatment and recovery.
I think I've learned over the years to not worry so much about what works for somebody else, as long as there's only one universal thing that we all have to do. The toilet paper has to go over the top. It can't come from the bottom. My only thing that I prescribe to everybody.
That's a whole different podcast.
You know, if I walk in someone's house, I'm like, ooh, this person's got problems. So you identified 6 different studies, and then you sent me another one yesterday. So 7 studies, and they're not necessarily comparative, but I also recognize I have my own biases as I was reading them. So I want to put that out there because I could not be completely objective because I have my own internal biases. But there were results that were surprising to me, and the others that were deductively seemed somewhat obvious. And I really liked the vet change study. I thought that there were things in there that was, you know, really interesting. So understanding the overall context of the studies were significantly different in each one. Were there results that you saw that contradicted each other?
I don't know if contradiction is quite the right word. I think how I more would describe it is as just very confusing because what you don't get from the research is clear guidance on who needs what when. You see in one study that abstinence improves quality of life and health. And then you read another study that says that moderation also in this study improves quality of life and health. And so where does that leave us? Where does that leave healthcare providers in knowing what goals that patients set for themselves are realistic or have a higher likelihood of working out beneficially for them? And I just will say, in the age of fentanyl and the overdose crisis, us not knowing, I think, can leave room for greater periods of experimentation, which in this day and age can often be deadly. And so I think there's just a high price to pay for us not knowing much about who would do better or worse, or what's realistic, what's overkill, what's underkill for every individual that walks into the door.
And I think that we may be able to identify some of that on a smaller scale, but it's very hard to generalize. And I go back to a study, Kathy Carroll, who was a researcher at Yale, absolutely brilliant. She was going to be my first podcast guest to talk about the importance of research. And unfortunately, she became ill and passed away. But she had been done a lot of studies and was a proponent of cognitive behavioral treatment, especially in terms of medication-assisted recovery at the time. And what she was working on a study with some folks up at Harvard and found out that with buprenorphine, using ongoing cognitive behavioral therapy for many was less than effective. It actually brought them back a little bit. So she had to rethink her perspective. And what she came out with that is, yeah, it's not good for everybody, but we don't know at the beginning. There are no qualities in each person that show us who it's not better for, that it's we have to look at what the patient wants and go from there, and risk levels.
Yeah. And one of the things, sort of some of the common threads that you can sort of piece together from the literature that exists, is that motivation, patient motivation, is important. Now, there's other literature saying that patients don't need to come into treatment with motivation. That's something they can develop during treatment. But we do know that motivation for your goal, whether that is moderation or abstinence, is helpful to reaching those goals. We also know from just the ways in which the studies are set up and how the world works that there is some patient self-selection, that some patients choose abstinence and some patients choose moderation. And then there's these kind of retrospective studies looking at, well, what type of people are most likely to choose moderation? What types of people are most likely to choose an abstinence pathway? And the tricky thing with that is, you know, are people self-selecting correctly? At what rates are they? And correctly is a strong word, but you know what I mean? And
yeah.
How much can we trust to know ourselves and to know the future, to know for ourselves without clear evidence or guidance from the medical community which pathway is better for us?
And we have to take other things into consideration, the overall context. Social determinants of health have a big kind of what's happening in that person's life. All of these things have to come into play. So we can't, there's more than just square pegs and round pegs. So it's not just trying to put a square peg into a round hole. There are many different sizes and shapes that we have to look at. So it really is an individual. There may be someone more likely to do better at this, but it's still individual choice and developing recovery capital and things like that.
Yeah. We also don't know, sort of within this data too, and patients' whole histories, because a lot of the narrative around abstinence is that patients try to moderate and they're not able to. And that leads them to the conclusion that abstinence is the only pathway forward for them to improve their lives and their health and recover.
from a practical perspective, you know, it's we have to recognize the barriers that clients face when they seek treatment for either pathway. You know, there's accessibility, stigma, discrimination, financial considerations, and all those things that we talk about, you know, with social determinants of health. But there's also a unique barrier, I believe, to moderation as a treatment goal. And you and I talked about this last week, and it was third-party payer unwilling to pay for such. They're not going to pay for you to moderate your use. Can you talk about that a little bit? Do you see that changing if there's more data on the effectiveness of moderation?
I actually see that changing regardless of the data, because I'm not sure that the research can catch up as fast as value-based care wants to go. You have great influxes culturally around person-centered care and moving towards person-centered care. You have harm reduction philosophies now kind of wide open and working themselves in throughout the continuum of care. What kind of a catch-22 right at the moment is that providers are being asked to provide patient-centered care, but they're only being reimbursed for abstinent outcomes, especially in some of the current value-based care models that exist. So, well, what if my patient doesn't want abstinence and that's not the goal? The payers are not necessarily recognizing moderation outcomes as this created value. And I did actually write another piece that talks about the competing ideologies that exist within the US and the healthcare system. And I think until we answer some really tough questions around capitalism and financing and ethics and harm reduction, that we're not going to really be able to move value-based care forward at the speed or at the rate or in the way that we would want to. I actually think this abstinence versus moderation conversation is holding up that entire reimbursement model.
Well, I won't tell Greg Williams that we had this conversation because I know value-based care is a lot of his work and his interest. So,
and I'm not saying that I disagree with value-based care. I don't want to get in trouble with Greg. I'm simply saying that it's hard to have a value-based care model if there's not agreed upon values.
Yeah,
or that's what the value should or would be.
And that's a conundrum that we kind of have to face. And I don't know if there's a simple answer. I don't think there is. But it's something that we have to figure out and be able to express to show the value of moderation. Of the studies that you referenced, are there one or two that you found more compelling overall?
I think the one that originally had stood out to me was SAMHSA's reporting out, actually kind of reversioning some data from the 2021 NISDA reports. Mm-hmm. Just on the sheer number of individuals saying they are in recovery, which for so long has been code word for abstinence, but are still continuing to use substances. And, you know, there's a lot of things here I don't have answers to. Like, I don't have conclusions on. There are things I'm sitting with and sitting on and trying to think about. And that's just kind of one of them, about like, what are the implications of this?
A lot of this leads into kind of my next question. It's one of the aspects of the article that really, really appealed to me is that you presented this evidence very simply and objectively without your own theory to support or development of a conclusion. People can read and just say, oh, this is what's there. I'm going to put you on the spot here. Have you drawn any conclusions about the abstinence moderation argument?
My conclusions have led me to the conclusion just about how little that we know, how far away we are from precision medicine. And it's also really drawn me towards, I don't know why this in particular, but, you know, substance use disorder is diagnosed in three categories as mild, moderate, and severe. But in all of this, I've realized that I've never seen a treatment program or a modality that customizes or makes their treatment person-centered to actually fit somebody's diagnostic level mm-hmm. of severity. And why I'm bringing this up is there are just so many complexities here about who's coming in and how are we providing people customized, tailored, person-centered care when we just don't know what is going to work best for who and when. And again, us having an overdose crisis and whatnot going on, that's a little scary to seem like we have all this data or research that needs to be done that we don't.
And it was a trick question, obviously, because there really isn't a conclusion other than there's way too many complexities right now to draw an effective conclusion. And we can say, as individual practitioners, I can say, I'm going to treat this person where they're at, but I can't say that and necessarily mean it because my organization may not allow me to do that. The payer may not allow to do that. The other forces in play may not allow someone to do that. So we've got a ways to go. We've got to understand more of each, I think. More research on abstinence-based so we can get a better picture rather than just go by, storytelling and go by our history and then look at moderation-based treatments for somebody who may not be as severe or wherever they fall on the spectrum and see what we get from that. So it's really, really interesting to me. There's a lot to learn. Before we finish up, is there anything that you'd like to share with our audience? You want to plug the National Council?
Well, I think my hope around these conversations is that we get more research that tries, and there's an ethical conundrums here to figure out how to pull this off, but that there is more research and investment in comparing moderation versus abstinence outcomes in, as we talked about, the variety of forms and pathways people mm-hmm. take even within those two terms, and the terms are not one thing, and that we kind of get away from some of the fear mongering language around certain things being under attack or certain things being better than others, or that there's something being lost here. Because I think at the end of the day, through research, through investigation, through data collection and analysis, we're really going to be able to revolutionize substance use disorder treatment in a way that's able to customize it for the individual. And we're not there yet, but we're going to get there, and it's going to be really cool. So
that will be really cool. And I think it's going to take both an intellectual and clinical curiosity that we have, Phil. And I encourage all of our listeners to learn more. If you have your feet in a certain camp, learn about the other camp. You don't have to agree with it, but be open to learning about it. And so that we can have educated conversations and meet our clients in the best spot. I certainly want to thank you for taking the time with us this morning. You had mentioned, what we're seeing with fentanyl and stuff. I want to let people know that our next podcast after this is with Bobby Lawler and Anna Gosinski of the New England HIDA. We're going to talk about their film Silence of the Streets and the fentanyl crisis and the difficulties in social determinants of health in urban environments. So thanks for that nice lead in.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and hopefully we can continue the conversation.
I have a feeling you and I will, Alexandra. I have a feeling we will. Thank you again, and we'll catch everybody next time.